Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on our program today, Transnet eyes a 127 billion rand rail and port expansion, but can it deliver while still posting billion rand losses? Mpox sweeping across Africa, exposing just how unprepared business is. Only 16% of municipalities earn clean audits. Could global standards be the key to fixing collapsing local government? And meat inflation pushing CPI to a 10-month high. It's Friday, the 12th of September. Now, Transnet's leadership says the freight, rail and ports operator is on the mend. Losses narrowing, private operators preparing to come onto the network and governance reforms in place. But for years, as you well know, the company has been crippled by corruption, inefficiency and theft. It's cost the South African economy billions. So the question, I guess, is how much has really changed and is the turnaround sustainable? I'm in conversation now with the Group Chief Executive Officer of Transnet, Michelle Phillips. A very warm welcome to you. Losses have narrowed, but can you say that Transnet is genuinely on a turnaround path? Are you not just benefiting perhaps from temporary fixes?
Thank you, Jeremy. Thanks for the question. Look, I think from the very beginning when we implemented the recovery plan, we were very clear that we wanted sustainable change in the organization. So we believe that the activities and the initiatives that we've implemented has put us on that path for sustainable recovery. These are not temporary fixes. You'll know that our recovery is not only based on operational initiatives or the tactical, but also on a transformation and reform of the organization. So we believe that these are sustainable changes going forward. Look, of course, there's a lot of work that we need to do, particularly on the, as you know, the theft and vandalism side, the derailments, the standard of the network. But I believe that with the necessary collaboration with all stakeholders and our companies that the and our customers, that we are able to achieve that and move forward sustainably.
Well, let me pick you up on that point as far as security and theft is concerned, particularly as far as cables go. It does plague operations. Mm-hmm. You will concede that. Why has Transnet constantly failed to get this under control?
Well, I think it's a problem that is a lot bigger than only Transnet. It needs to be something that is resolved by the country at large, because it's really a manifestation of the crime situation in the country. But I mean, 23% decline in the number of incidents is quite a good improvement compared from where we've come from. So I do believe, again, that even on the theft and vandalism side, that we are on the right track. But I mean, the losses are too much for us to sustain. And, you know, that's why we need all the authorities and everybody to play a meaningful contribution and to, in fact, contribute to us not only reducing theft and vandalism on critical infrastructure, but generally in the country, it is a problem. So, I mean, there's a lot of work for everybody to do. But I think that, you know, with everything that has happened so far, I think you would have seen recently over the past few days, there's been quite a few arrests as well. So there's a lot of activity. And, you know, currently we are also over 25% below where we were last year. So it's not a failure. I think that there's an improvement, but we would like to see more of an improvement.
And add to that, of course, corruption, which has hollowed out Transnet for years. Are you confident, yes, Michelle Phillips, that this has been truly rooted out, or do you still continue to uncover new cases within the organization?
Jeremy, I think that by far we have succeeded pretty much in running a clean business, as I would call it. I've been very clear since my appointment that I do not want to be known by anything other than having run and turning around this business through clean business practices. We do find the odd instance here and there, but I can tell you we get in there, we focus, we investigate, and we deal with the perpetrators, and we engage with the police so that we can get people arrested if need be, and a lot of controls that we've implemented in the business as well. We do, as I've said, we do find the odd incidents, but we have set up in the organization as well, which I am sponsoring, what we call an ethics unit, where we go, straight into the business where we find these instances. We've educated people on whistleblowing, and we get in there and we investigate and we take action. I'm certainly not going to say that it's disappeared, but I'm going to say that people are a lot more careful because we will not tolerate any such corrupt activities in our business.
Michelle, looking to the future, you plan to spend something in the region of 125, 127 billion rand on rail and port expansion. How's it going to be funded, and what ultimately will your customers, and for that matter, South Africans, see at the end of this?
Yes. So, the support that we have received from government in terms of guarantees has also assisted us to be able to, make these decisions when it comes to the network and the ports business. So I think more than 80% of that 127 billion is in fact on sustaining capital. It is to get the infrastructure and the network to the right standards. And then, of course, you would have seen some of the deliveries, particularly in the ports, in terms of port equipment. On the rail side, we've introduced new locomotives. That is all intended to get us to this 250 million target that the minister has set for the country. Of course, we will be doing that together with private operators, the 250. But there's a lot of work to be done on this network. That we've suffered almost 7 million tons due to derailments. So we need to repair and rehabilitate the network and of course also give the people in the port the tools to do what we require from them. So we feel that 25 billion a year is the right number for us to invest, and we will be funding that. Fortunately, our funders have come to the party. They want to do business with us. They want to invest in Transnet and our customers as well. So I don't think that we are going to have a problem with funding. The results have also created a renewed, I suppose, belief in Transnet and what this organization is capable of. And we are being approached, by funders who see the potential in this organization.
You speak about the private operators. You've also promised within the next 12 to 36 months. But what is the biggest risk here? Is it that Transnet maybe won't be able to compete with the private operators, or simply you won't relinquish control enough to make competition meaningful?
No, Jeremy, I think we need to focus on the goal here and the objective. The objective for us to make meaningful contribution to the economy of this country is for South Africa to move 250 million tons. Transnet itself has a target this year for over 180 million tons. That tells us that we have a gap that needs to be filled if we want to get to the 250. So my advice to everybody and to the private operators as well is let's focus on getting to the 250 as a country, and then we can allow the competition to happen organically.
Just a quick one in conclusion. What's the single biggest risk to your survival, Michelle Phillips? Is it corruption, crime, cash flow, or politics, or a combination of all of it?
Combination of all of it. Look, this is a business. It is an enterprise. It is a state-owned enterprise. I think what is important for us is that we keep our eye on the ball. We run a clean business. We don't allow ourselves to be influenced by corrupt or criminal individuals. And we keep the country's interests at heart. And if we are focused on doing that, then I think that we will get to where we need to be in terms of South Africa, again, being up there globally and competing with the rest of the world.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Michelle Phillips, Group Chief Executive Officer of Transnet.
MoneyWeb at midday. For all your up-to-date stories.
Now, Mpox, formerly monkeypox, is a contagious infectious disease caused by the Mpox virus, and I read it's again surging in parts of Africa. And while it's a health story, it's also a business risk story. Outbreaks like Mpox don't just threaten lives, they disrupt supply chains, reduce productivity, and expose how unprepared many organizations remain, despite the lessons of COVID-19. Now, with Africa deeply integrated into global trade and investment, this is no longer a regional issue, but it is, I would suggest, a global economic concern. Joining me now is Dr. Isaac Ankanko, who's medical director for Central Africa at International SOS. Dr. Ankanko, welcome to you and thank you very much indeed. No doubt Mpox is a wake-up call for business. Have we been ignoring something like this since COVID-19? What's the big issue here?
Indeed, Mpox has been a concern since COVID-19 as the next infectious disease that we've seen within the African continent, more specifically within Western Central African regions. One of the biggest concerns that we have seen in the medical sector is that the lessons that we have picked up from COVID-19 in terms of private sector preparedness remains dangerously low, posing risk to business continuity, risk towards workforce health and operational continuity, as I mentioned. It is becoming more and more concerning if you look at how businesses position themselves in terms of mitigating and protecting their workforce on the part of duty of care.
Doctor, how exposed are companies today then if another outbreak spreads quickly across our borders?
So the challenge here is that with regards to companies being more purposeful and putting measures in place, what we've seen is that most companies are adopting generic templates for their infectious disease preparedness versus having to have tailored-made protocols in place to ensure that they can timely escalate and also activate responses. Another challenge is the early warning systems that they've put in place in terms of monitoring outbreaks within different jurisdictions. I mean, you would agree with me that we're not in a bubble. People travel. So if a country has an outbreak, it's just a matter of time that it could spread into due to travels. So all these are very important, significant areas that we need to put into cognizance, and also the providing the necessary trusted information to our workforce.
Are you able to tell me which industries on the continent are most at risk and why?
I would say, I mean, we all pretty much at risk in terms of the exposure. We talk about the extractive industries, such as mining, oil and gas, because such disruptions causes major operational challenges with business continuity. You look at the supply chain, which is critical. We saw what happened during COVID, where businesses come to a standstill, individual lives, shops, grocery shoppings, etc. So pretty much we all at risk. And I would like to say that we shouldn't downplay and limit it to specific industries. Of course, the health sector usually are in the front line and they pose the biggest risk in terms of exposure. But I would like to say that all companies, all sectors need to take this seriously and put in place the necessary measures.
In your experience, do you think there is enough collaboration between business and government when it comes to planning, or are companies simply left to fend for themselves?
I think more can be done. There's quite some synergy ongoing, but more can be done. Why? These infectious disease outbreaks, example, Mpox, it's usually a public health emergency and usually driven and controlled by the respective jurisdiction public health sector. So private businesses collaborating with governments can strengthen a lot of health systems and also put in place measures to mitigate these outbreaks. There are different ways of collaborating in terms of the whole infectious disease management plans. Doesn't necessarily always have to come with money. There are different information systems, there are training systems, there are even logistics in terms of supporting various countries with moving materials, vaccines, PPEs from point A to point B. So this is the time that we need more collaboration between the private sector and then the governments.
And just finally, Doctor, there's always going to be difficulty in balancing, I would imagine, employee health and safety with the pressure to keep operations and supply chains running.
Yes. So the important bit is we need to ensure that these two are not competing, but they are given the right attention in parallel, because employee health, it's very core in terms of human resource for the organization, and as well as ensuring that you have the business and supply chain going hand in hand. So what are organizations doing to ensure that their human resource or human resource capital are protected, ensuring that wellness and a conducive working environment so that they can discharge their day-to-day activities. So this is where individual companies need to put in place critical protocols that are tailor-made, need to ensure that employees are well-informed, good trusted information is communicated to them, and ensure that they have a good health partner where they can escalate and provide guidance. We at International SOS provide such support to our corporate clients by helping them put in place specific outbreak business continuity plans with clear escalation protocols, and as well as ensuring that communication is very authentic and trusted for their employees.
Thank you very much indeed. I've been in conversation with Dr. Isaac Ankanko, who's Medical Director for Central Africa at the International SOS. Thank you so much, Doctor.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, South Africa's municipalities, I don't need to tell you, are in crisis. Collapsing infrastructure, poor service delivery and audit outcomes that show only 16% are managing to meet basic clean governance standards. At the heart of the problem, weak performance management and shockingly low productivity. One expert believes the answer lies in international standards, frameworks that could transform municipal efficiency and restore public trust. So let's talk about that in a little more detail. I'm in conversation with Muhammad Ali, Managing Director of WWISE, it's Worldwide Industrial and Systems Engineers, and let's see what kind of proposals there are to turn things around. Muhammad, only 41 out of 257 municipalities receiving clean audits, and a very warm welcome to you. How did we sink into such an alarming state of dysfunction, do you think?
I think there's multiple factors that have led to where we are right now. And I think we need to go back to the basics. That's how I've understood and analyzed this through all the research and the data that's been provided. Coming from an engineering background, a lot is in the data. A lot is in us analyzing it and making, you know, effective, factual, evidence-based decision-making. And what I mean by that is going back to the basics. If you're a soccer player, the basic is to be able to try and pass the ball. And I think we have missed a step or two and trying to play in the Champions League without knowing what the general basics are. And the basics are governed by what we call standards, whether it's a national standard, a South African national standard, whether it's an international standard, or these frameworks that we have not just created. It's the best minds and technical committee experts around the world that have sat down together to come up with frameworks that can guide and assist organizations to be able to improve. I think, firstly, We do always talk about there's a skill shortage, there's a challenge, but we are paying consultants who also are coming at a premium fee from whether it's the Big Five or any consulting firm, and they're sending out juniors who have academical experience, and that's basically it, you know? Mm-hmm. And then the seniors are just reviewing reports, and the consultants are giving advice. They're not actually implementing. And I think that's where the root cause is that we've got municipalities. They have no standard or guidelines to follow. The interpretation of the regulations, the statutory requirements are not clearly interpreted or understood. We don't know what skill we need to be able to deliver on these requirements. We do not have key performance indicators that are SMART or specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, and time-bound. And we're not trained, or the skill force or the workforce is not trained to know what to do and how to do it in order to execute it. And it just feels like the blind is leading the blind, and we're just going in circles. All we do is talk and get advice, but we never get to implement or actually get to see the true value of what service delivery should be. And we're not even learning from the 16% of municipalities that have actually passed.
Let's talk a little bit about that implementation, and particularly the skills issue. How much of the problem that you're outlining to me is a shortage of skills and capacity versus mismanagement of the skills that we already have?
That's a very good point. I actually personally don't feel that we've got a shortage of skills in certain areas. I think when someone comes to apply for a job, you know, they are willing, and you need to be able to deem their particular performance on merit. And I think that's where we lose the plot a little bit, because a lot of the people that are appointed are not, you know, they're perhaps selected as opposed to elected, if I can call it as such. And that is one of the common issues that we have. But be that as it may, when a particular individual comes in to fulfill a role, there is no understanding of what exactly they need to do, how do they need to do it, what tools that they are required to understand in order to deliver and achieve to meet a common goal and objective. There's no guidance on it. And because the top management, if you can call it as such, is just burning out fires and they're not focusing on strategy, because the turnaround or the lifespan of these top management in the municipal areas is so short. They come in, they set out objectives and targets. Within the space of 6 months or a year, they are then removed, or even less than 3 years. And now it's been so overly regulated to a point where people look at prior projects and they just cancel them, and they don't want to pay the suppliers or go onto it, and they come with new projects. And it's so overregulated, you don't trust the process. So top management do not even sign on anything that is not something that they have endorsed or are familiar with, which is put a huge bottleneck on service delivery. So it's a combination of having the skill, but I do think we do, giving them the right training and giving them the right model of inducting them, and with the right tools, and having management given a longer period of time to prove themselves with consequence management and accountability.
But the elephant in the room, Mohammed, is political interference. CADA deployment and patronage have hollowed out so many municipalities. How do you overcome that political interference, or do you think it has become too entrenched?
I do think it's entrenched, and I do think it's going to take the wheel to turn for it to actually start adding value. And I think that's where I'm saying we need to align ourselves to a standard. So my approach is be transparent and do open heart surgery, as they call it. This famous saying where Ralf Rangnick, the ex-Manchester United coach, said that Man United needs to go through a particular open heart surgery in order for us to be able to understand where the root causes are and slowly look at coming up with a plan on improving. And I think we're falling in that particular same boat, if you want to use a soccer analogy. And I think we need to look at these standards and frameworks and do open heart surgery and understand exactly where we are falling short in every element, whether it's performance management, whether it's productivity, whether it's policies, regulations, where we don't understand, we don't know how to interpret. And then we use a risk-based approach to be able to mitigate where our challenges are. And each risk when we are mitigating them, we need to create that mitigation into a particular smart KPI or an objective, which we hold our top management team accountable for. And from that approach, we then empower the right people by giving them the right tool sets, the right particular induction, the right mode of training, not just reading a policy, doing it in blended ways so that people can interpret and understand what to do and right. how to do it, and performance manage it. And I think that may be a way of doing things. And I've taken this from Rwanda, Algeria, and Singapore as case studies.
But let me put this to you finally then, all well and good, but the model that you're proposing requires a commitment of a lot of money. And given that municipal finances are already under strain, Mohammed, is this realistic or just pie in the sky?
It's realistic if you have the right leaders driving this, because at the end of the day, there is a risk acceptance that someone must be accountable for. So if you're not willing to finance a particular project in order to improve service delivery, the board or the team that have rejected that must accept the consequences of that risk and be held accountable to that. And I think that's when you will be able to get drive and you will be able to get results. And you need the right leaders with the right drive, the right discipline, determination, and dedication, and most importantly, communication to be able to drive this. Otherwise, it's just exactly what you said, pie in the sky.
Mohammed Ali, thank you very much indeed. Managing Director of Worldwide Industrial and Systems Engineers, I do appreciate your time. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, I don't need to tell you that dry season is here, but the coals are cold for many households. With CPI at a 10-month high of 3.5% on the back of soaring meat prices, South Africans are cutting not just luxuries but essentials, juggling shrinking incomes and rising debt. So let's talk about this spring of survival, so to speak, from National Debt Advisors Samantha Monyana. Very warm welcome. Let's start with the braai, if we can. How exactly is meat-driven inflation, do you think, challenging or changing the average Heritage Day braai and the budget behind it? We really are struggling to put boerewors on the fire, right?
Definitely. Hi, Jeremy. Thank you so much for the opportunity. You know, Heritage is no longer going to feel like Heritage Month, whereby each and every single household is braaiing, because now, as we know, that the increase in meat has gone drastically high. And, you know, most consumers are now very tight on their budget. So it's best to buy much more affordable meat like chicken compared to our steak and the beef and the lamb.
CPI at 3.5% doesn't sound extreme, but it really is brutal at the till, isn't it?
Definitely it is. You know, with most of this, consumers now, what they have to do is to buy in bulk, to buy when there are specials, because now what you used to spend previously on your meat or on your groceries is no longer going to be the same considering the inflation rise. So I highly suggest that people should just go for bulk or go for the specials that are there, because who can afford now to buy a lot of meat at a normal decent price, you know? So rather get the bargains when you can.
Unemployment at 33.2%, and particularly for women at 35, let's call it 36%. Have you done any work on how this is skewing household debt risk, particularly for single income families?
Women face the heaviest burden with an unemployment rate at 35.9%, as you've mentioned, compared to 31.0% of men. So even women graduates are experiencing high unemployment than their male peers. Unemployment and reduced income makes it difficult for households to repay debt, leading to debt distress and potential defaults. And the rising living costs and debt repayment obligation can also leave households with limited disposable income for saving. The pressure to service debt and living expenses can lead to a lot of stress amongst women or as a household as a whole.
And Samantha, we also are seeing a surge in something called lifestyle debt. What is that? Well, it's credit used to keep up appearances, even as essentials are being cut. Have you noticed that?
Yes, I have. You know, so many people are really relying on debt. They cannot live without debt. The moment you get paid, you take out a payday loan. They debit that money you have to take out. So people cannot live without debt anymore because I understand inflation has gone up. Salaries are quite stagnant. And most people have so many debt that they need to service on a monthly basis. It has become people's lifestyle, which is a really not good lifestyle that one can find themselves in. But how can they not find themselves in it if they don't have much?
Samantha, we hear about debt consolidation all the time, yet the argument is that it could just be a smart pressure valve. Or is it a trap if behavior doesn't change? What red flags are you seeing in that respect?
You know, debt consolidation depends on you as a consumer when you put yourself in why do you want to consolidate your debt? So many people had found themselves debt-free by consolidating the debt in a form of maybe getting a consolidation loan, settling all your debt, and then pay that loan back, or in a form of you applying for a debt review process. So it's entirely up to you as a consumer how you make use of the service that has been rendered to you, because so many consumers will get that opportunity, but they do not keep up with the monthly repayment, and they'll find themselves in worse positions than what they've been in.
But difficult for so many people to keep up with that minimum monthly repayment, though. They're caught between a rock and a hard place, aren't they?
Definitely. And also, even though, for example, you find a consumer that you consolidated a debt, which they were paying, for example, let's say 6,000 rand a month. I'm just making an example. Mm. Then you consolidate for 2,500 rand. The other monies that you have saved, people end up creating more expenses on that money, the surplus that they have saved, or find themselves having other debt, maybe loan sharks. So how are you going to find yourself out of a situation if you are in the process of getting help? So I highly suggest that consumers need to also control themselves. Stop being impulsive, stop being tempted, because sometimes you're not taking a loan because you need it, you are taking it because it's available to you.
For a household, Samantha, that is already in arrears, is there a sequence? Who gets paid first, who gets called, and what should people do in that respect?
You know, when you find yourself not able to service your debt and now you're in arrears, it is very important to consult whichever financial institution you have debt with. Communicate with them. Okay, I'm unable to commit to the installment that you provided me with. How about I make an arrangement? Because you not paying your debt is just going to put you in a more worse position than what you are in. It's very important to communicate. Better paying than not paying anything at all. Because the debt will always be in your name. Whether you run away, whether you change your bank account, that will always follow you.
Thank you very much indeed. From National Debt Advisors, I've been talking to Samantha Munyana. And that is where we're going to leave it for today and for the week. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.